Well, if I would have known I was speaking in the main role, I would have prepared to talk about anxiety, not about ADHD. But too late. Okay, there's a handout coming around, which is kind of important. So if you could, if you're one of the first 40 people in the room, because that's all there are for handouts, then please take a look. Okay, so there's a certain pattern that you see in Tanakh and sometimes in davening. So there's a pasuk in Tehillim. The pasuk says, "Tevil leDavid, Hatei Hashem Oznecha, Anein." So first, David the Melech says, "Hatei Hashem Oznecha, listen, turn your ear towards me to listen. Then Anein, then answer me." Similarly, we have in Melachim Beis, Chizkiyahu HaMelech is davening to Hashem, Sacherov is coming. So Chizkiyahu HaMelech starts his davening, he says, Hatei Hashem Oznecha, same language as David HaMelech, Ushma. So turn, incline your ear, turn your ear and hear. Pekah Hashem Einecha Urei. Open your eye towards me, Hashem, and see. So we clearly see this pattern in Tanakh also of a request for attention from Hashem. Before we ask for Hashem to answer our davenings, we ask for Hashem to pay attention. My five-year-old figured this out a couple of years ago. He's our fourth child, and there's a lot going on in the house. So when he wants my attention, he will come. I think he learned this when he was three by himself. He's the only one in the house who does this. He'll come to me and he'll take my chin and turn it to him and make eye contact with me and say, Abba, and he'll tell me what he wants to tell. So attention is clearly a very important topic. The topic for today's talk is ADHD and the Yeshiva classroom, what every mechanech needs to know. So in order to really understand ADHD, we need to look at it in depth, and we'll try to do the best we can in the time we have. What is ADHD? Let's take a look. If you take your hand out and turn to the first page, of course, there's debates all over the internet, and Rabbi Kaplan is talking about their blogs about this, I'm sure. Is ADHD a myth? Is it a fact? Is conspiracy theories for dummies, if you see that book in a handout? Is ADHD just a ploy for money for drug companies, excusing childhood behavior away because children are just being lazy and we're calling it something to excuse it away? I don't believe so. If you look at the chart beneath it, this big square, there's a few kinds of charts like this. This shows the impact of ADHD. It's a real, actual syndrome. 50% increase in bike accidents, 33% increase in emergency room visits. Substance use disorders and untreated ADHD, double the risk, earlier onset. What happens to your employer, to the parents of the children with ADHD, and to the families in ADHD? There's lots and lots of outcomes that are negative beyond just the classic symptoms inside the classroom. Let's turn the page to look at the diagnosis, diagnostic issues. In psychology and psychiatry, we define disabilities and disorders by specific behavioral patterns. Having one piece of a pattern does not constitute a pattern, but having the whole pattern does constitute the pattern, and it implies certain things about what's going on in your brain. ADHD, as you see on the top two slides in the handout, there's an inattentive category and there's an impulsivity category. Each of those have 9 criteria. You need to meet 6 out of the 9 to meet any of those criteria for the slides, and we'll just go through it quickly. So those top two slides, if you want to technically, halakhically have inattentive or impulsive characteristics of ADHD, those are the details. In the second row, on the bottom on the left-hand side, there's the 3 subtypes of ADHD. There's the predominantly inattentive type, which is the minority. Actually, part of that might constitute a separate disorder. Further research will be looking at this. There's something called sluggish cognitive tempo, which is a new disorder that will probably be coming out. So that number might actually be lower. There's a predominantly hyperactive impulsive type, which on the surface, the slide says it's 10%, but really, I think that's an artifact of the next category, which is the combined type, which is the overwhelming majority of ADHD. So probably most of the hyperactive, impulsive children were also diagnosed with inattention as well. Russell Barkley, who's the main researcher about ADHD, talks about how impulsivity is the core characteristic across all of ADHD. By the way, just for perspective about ADHD, approximately 9.5% of the childhood population in this country are diagnosed with ADHD. That boils down to 13.5% of boys and about 5.3% of girls. So it's a major disorder that's been diagnosed millions of children, In terms of the adult literature, I think it's officially 4.1% of adults in this country are diagnosed with ADHD, although that is probably an underdiagnosis because we have many more sources of reasons to push someone to become identified when they're a child, not so much when they're an adult. Now, overall, this is a pattern of difficulty sustaining attention over time, especially in the face of distraction, and especially to stimuli that the child is not motivated to learn right now. Let's examine what causes this pattern so we can understand it better. If you turn to the next page, the biological model of ADHD. So the top picture is a picture of your brain. The brain has three parts. There's the hindbrain, which is the most immature, fundamental part of the brain, composed of the cerebellum, the pons, and medulla that control breathing, swallowing, blood circulation. Without your hindbrain working, you can't live. Then there's the midbrain structures, which we'll pass over. Then there's the forebrain, and the most famous forebrain structure is the cerebral cortex, which is that spaghetti-like structure we used to see in all the pictures of what a brain looks like. The big bowl of spaghetti is your cerebral cortex. Your cortex, as you see in the picture, is divided into four lobes. The lobe that we're most interested in right now is the frontal lobe, which is right behind your forehead, on top of your head. And that is immature in ADHD children. What does the frontal lobe do? Why do we care? The frontal lobe is in charge of abstract thinking, decision-making, problem-solving, control of purposeful behaviors, consciousness, and emotions. So obviously, that's something we kind of need in life and in classrooms. If you move down on the page, structural differences, there's a slide that says a 3D high-resolution MRI image of the brain of a patient with ADHD. If you could sort of make out the idea, at least behind the slide, is that there's a certain physical immaturity in that forebrain structure that is responsible for these abilities that we so sorely need. If you move down on the page, there's a slide that says anterior cingulate fails to activate in ADHD. What is the anterior cingulate and why do we care about it? The other slide is also talking about divisions of the anterior cingulate, which is not so important right now. Whenever you have a conflict between the events of the now and what's going to happen in the future, if you continue to act this way, the anterior cingulate is the brain structure that helps you negotiate this conflict, the conflict between your short-term and your long-term benefits. The frontal lobe can suppress your emotion to keep your long-term goals in line, but only through the anterior cingulate. And if you look at the slide, there's a little gray box in the middle. The normal control, the non-ADHD person, there's a little white area in the middle of that. That's an activation. His anterior cingulate was active and working during a certain task. The same task for the ADHD child, that gray box is all dark inside. It was not activating. So it was not mediating between his long-term and short-term goals. So here's an example. If we combine this with impulsivity, of course. You're sitting at a meeting at work, and your supervisor comes in, and there's a bunch of people at the meeting, and your supervisor says, this year we are not giving out any raises, and we're taking away all the sick days. So everyone in their mind is angry at the supervisor. That's an appropriate emotion to have. They're angry, and they're cursing at the supervisor in their mind, and they want to punch the supervisor in the nose, but they don't. But the person with ADHD, because he doesn't have that shut-off switch, instead of the thought and impulse stopping at the base of the brain, at the base of your skull, it continues and goes into the spinal cord, into your mouth, into your arms and legs, and you jump over the table, and you punch the supervisor in the nose while you're cursing him out, and then you're fired. And that's your long-term goals not being in sync with your short-term goals. And that is a bona fide problem structurally with ADHD. Let's turn the page to neurochemistry. The brain is filled with billions of neurons, and neurons have to talk to each other. That's how the brain works smoothly. So how do neurons talk to each other? They talk to each other through neurochemicals. If I have two neurons here and here, neuron A wants to speak to neuron B, it will send a neurochemical out, which will be picked up by neuron B, and then neuron B will continue to do the same through your brain. What happens to the neurochemical when it's between the cells? Some of it gets picked up by the next cell, and some of it gets recycled and pulled back up by the original cell which sent it out. The main interest that we have here in ADHD, of course, is the frontal lobe, and the main kind of neurotransmitter we're interested in is something called dopamine, which is a popular and famous neurotransmitter. There are two problems with the dopamine system in ADHD children. Number one, research has shown that in ADHD children compared to non-ADHD children, 70% more of the dopamine is pulled back up by the first cell than is available for non-ADHD children. So if you're an ADHD child, you might have the same amount of dopamine in your brain, inside your nerves, but you don't have enough of it circulating. You have 70% less circulating than is supposed to be circulating. And more than that, on the receiving cell side, research has shown that there are 16% fewer receptors on the postsynaptic cell, on the cell on the that is supposed to receive the message from the dopamine. You have less docking sites for those neurochemicals. You have less neurochemicals available in the cleft because more of it's being vacuumed up, and you have less sites for it to dock. And that's really primarily the role of medications to help regulate this, either for the uptake, so you have more of your own neurochemicals available. People think sometimes of medication that you're introducing a new chemical into your brain to do something different. But really, it's helping this system work more efficiently, your own natural system, to work the way it's supposed to. Now let's turn the page to ADHD concepts. The reason that I talked about that biology is because it's important to understand where this is happening in the brain and what's happening in the brain, because the next section is about executive functions. Executive functions happen in that frontal lobe, that part of the brain that's not working properly. That's where your executive functions happen. What are executive functions? Executive functions are those traits that shift your behavior from being controlled by the immediate environment around you, which is otherwise called our impulse, to being controlled by the internally represented forms of information. So if someone pushes me, then I move because of my environment around me. If I decide to take a step or not take a step, that's me making a decision based on internally represented forms of information, which is usually what we're asking children to do. Now there are four executive functions, and when we see these functions, we'll understand why they're so important, of course, for children in school. The first one is nonverbal working memory, the ability to use visual imagery or memories of sensory information to guide our behavior, to create mental maps that we can draw upon from our own mind to guide ourselves. These create the important skills of hindsight, foresight, and our sense of time. That's one executive function. Second executive function, also extremely important, is verbal working memory, the internalization of speech, the ability to speak to yourself, to self-question, to problem-solve, a voice in your head giving you instructions how to navigate yourself through novel situations. If you can use this self-talk, you can guide yourself to do the right behaviors at the right times. Number three, self-regulation of emotion and motivation and arousal. Of course, this is what we talked about with the anterior cingulate and the supervisor example. And number four is reconstitution, analysis and synthesis, taking units of behavior apart, recombining them to form new and proper behaviors to be appropriate to the situations. This is, of course, important for planning and problem solving. Now, in ADHD, these executive functions are not being used as they should to guide behavior. Why are they not being used? So the main reason they're not being used is because of the next concept, which is behavioral inhibition. Behavioral inhibition, as you see at the bottom of the page, is the ability to stop what you're doing in order to allow the executive functions to take over and guide your behavior towards the future. Behavioral inhibition does not cause executive functioning, of course. It allows executive functioning. It creates a pause in time for your mind to do what it knows it can do and for it to do what it knows it should do. But you need to have that pause. Russell Barkley talks about how in most animal species, the mind does not have that time, does not have that behavioral inhibition. That's why he feels, from an evolutionary perspective, animals have not developed the skill of speech. Certainly not like we've developed the skill of speech, because if you respond immediately without inhibition, you don't have space for speech to come in, and for speech, even internalized speech, to guide your behaviors. So internalized speech and all the other executive functions can only happen if we have the skill of behavioral inhibition. If we can inhibit our behavior, inhibit our impulses, then we could use the rest of our mind. And we'll see why this is important very soon. If you turn the page, there are three processes involved in behavioral inhibition, and just to skip to C on that, it creates a delay and protects this period of delay from being disrupted by competing events. Obviously, that translates very clearly into a classroom situation. There's many competing events aside from the teacher speaking in the classroom. There's a child tapping his pencil. There's whatever's happening in the window or in the hallway. Protecting this period of delay so a person can use their internalized speech and use their executive functions so they can function properly in the classroom is completely controlled by behavioral inhibition. Now let's turn the page to key concepts where we can bring all of these ideas together. Okay, more key concepts page, I'm sorry. So we've said that ADHD is a disorder where, number one, a child has a difficulty sustaining attention over time. He appears less motivated to sustain attention over time, especially in the face of distractions. Now, I wrote in the note, this answers the video game and reading a fun book question, because children can be diagnosed with ADHD, but yet the kasha parents have is, but he can sit in his bed reading his favorite book or playing his favorite video game for 3 hours in a row. So the reason that that's not a question on ADHD is because ADHD is very specific, because we learned about requiring, it's a disorder for you being able to use your own executive functions. Playing your computer games does not require your executive functions. It does not require you to tap into long-term visual memory to decide what's the difference between your goals right now and your goals in the future. Your goals right now and in the future are the same if you're on your bed playing your video game. It's a disorder to sustain your attention when you're less motivated to do a task and when you're being distracted from that task, which is not the case when you're in your room playing your video game. Number two, a very important concept, is that ADHD is not a disorder of skill. It's a disorder of performance. Performance is what happens in our frontal lobe. Skill happens in other parts of our brain. ADHD children have skills. They have intelligence. They have many abilities that they're just not showing in the classroom or at home. And this is important to keep in mind when we think about how we speak to children with ADHD who have misbehaved in terms of guilt trips. And also in terms of not being fooled by what they say. They know what's right and wrong. They just can't always act on it, especially without help. Concept number three, time. As we saw in the executive function list, time is the enemy. Children have difficulty conforming to behavioral expectations that are bound to past and future consequences in time. As we talked about, foresight and hindsight are difficult concepts to naturally resonate with if you have ADHD. The goal, if you're working with such a child, is to try to eliminate time from the equation. Consequences are important. Consequences make things immediate. The consequences must be given immediately, frequently, and must be external, salient, and consistent, so that way they're predictable. That way you are able, as a child, to not need as much frontal lobe energy in order to conjure up what is going to happen and what you should do. Sometimes people have meetings and talks with ADHD children and you feel you've gotten to a point of trust and goodwill. But trust and goodwill are very important and nice, but it's not enough. It's not enough to hold the mind of an ADHD children on the task that they're supposed to be doing. Another important point that Barclay and other researchers make is the idea of point of performance. Point of performance is the number one frustration for therapists because a therapist sits in a room in a different office, maybe even in a different city with a client from where the classroom is, and you're having a long discussion with your 10, 11-year-old patient about what he should or shouldn't do in the classroom. It doesn't generalize. No matter how well they speak the game inside your office, or even inside the principal's office, or even to a teacher in the hallway, it doesn't necessarily generalize to the situation. All interventions have to be, the most appropriate interventions at least, have to be at the point of performance. The place that you're expecting the behavior to occur, that is where the kind of intervention, which we'll get to in a moment, needs to happen. Number four, there's the 30% rule, give or take. ADHD children tend to have a 30% delay in maturity compared to same age peers. This, of course, is now obvious when we think about the earlier slides about the immature structures in the forebrain. So, of course, they would appear to be less mature because they are less mature. The reason that the statistics about adult ADHD is smaller than child ADHD is because, at least historically, the research showed that half the time your brain catches up. So that would kind of halve the statistics for the incidence of ADHD as an adult. And that delay catches up when your brain catches up. But it's not clear entirely if that's always true. And certainly for 4 to 5% of the population of adults, it's certainly not true. Within this 30% rule, if you think about a child's social skills and organizational skills, there's such a difference in the age of children. If you think of a 44-year-old versus a 40-year-old, they're in the same place. But if you think of a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, they're in a very different place. If you look at a 10-year-old and expect 10-year-old behavior, but see 6 or 7-year-old behavior, then you're very disappointed, and that creates a problem in a school setting and a home setting for sure. So we need to readjust our expectations and our approach based on what we really believe the actual maturity level of someone, if we correct the age to the maturity age. Next, number five, social skills are delayed due to executive function deficits. Number six, keep in mind, research has shown from preschool and beyond, ADHD actually, for boys more than girls, endure far more negative messages and interactions from their parents than same age peers. And this finding of how much negative messages they tend to get tends to predict greater non-compliance in the classroom. So as a teacher, a Rebbe or a Mora, You're dealing with a child who might be coming into school more upset and burdened and likely to be more oppositional because of what they've been through to get into your classroom. Charles Schaefer is one of the very famous child psychologists who's written prolifically, which probably means his graduate students write for him prolifically. But Charles Schaefer talks about oppositional defiant disorder, which is a disorder that's highly correlated with ADHD. And he developed three models for how ADHD leads into oppositional defiant disorder. And we don't have time for that now, but one theory is that based on what we've spoken about now and understand from the brain structures, ADHD children have a poor ability to naturally resonate with rule-governed behavior. If you have trouble wrapping your brain around rule-governed behavior, you're going to become, or you're likely to become, an oppositional defiant child. And that requires its own set of techniques, which is beyond the scope of the time from which they're going to yank me down from here. Number seven, peer relationship findings. This is also important to have perspective for your child or your student about what else is going on in their life. Peer relationship findings, number one, A, despite talking more, they're less likely to respond to questions or verbal interaction of their peers. So you might see someone and assume that your student is very verbal, and of course you see them interacting with their peers, so of course there's lots of healthy back and forth, but they might not actually be responding as much as their peers would be responding. B, they tend to be less knowledgeable about social skills and appropriate behaviors with others. C, more of an external locus of control. They feel like their behavior is not necessarily guided by their own priorities and their own whims and wishes, but may be pulled away by other forces. So they might have less personal responsibility. And if they feel less personal responsibility for their behaviors, what does that translate to when you get to junior high or beyond about how a person understands themselves and what makes them tick? D, which is also very important, they tend to overinterpret the actions of others as having hostile intentions, which of course compounds itself when an ADHD child tends to get into trouble more and they tend to get disciplined more. If they anyway overinterpret hostile intentions, how much more so does that make them feel inside? Number eight, transitions are very difficult for ADHD children. This is a very big yesod for anyone dealing with an ADHD child, how to navigate this. Transitions require attention to stop, shift to the new correct target, and begin again. It's very hard to shift between recess and class and lunch and class and between periods and subjects and taking out which book. It's better for you to get ahead of the curve and to transition them instead of expecting them, the child with a disorder, to be able to do this by themselves. One example of trying to do this, sometimes, this doesn't always work, but sometimes it pays if you can, if it fits the way your school works and your class works, to actually have the child outside of the classroom, for example, settle down the class, transition the class, allow the class to transition themselves, and then with a quiet class, starting the work to bring in that other child and you to more easily be able to transition that child to an already working environment, rather than have all the competing and distracting stimuli make the transition time harder. Let's turn the page. Number nine, nutrition. Nutrition is very important. The dopamine that we talked about earlier in this talk is created from food that has protein. And it's created primarily in the early morning or early afternoon. Children often come in without eating breakfast and without eating a proper lunch. Even if they have food, they might be either too impulsive or if their medication is taking away their appetite. It's important for everyone who's working with a child to understand what are they eating. And what can we do about it? How can we get more protein into them in the morning? It's a last-ditch effort. Different researchers talk about different ideas. Some talk about even using ice cream, and you can mix in protein powder into the ice cream as a last-ditch effort. But you have to figure out a way to have proper nutrition. Otherwise, the child's not going to be able to function. Barclay talks about refilling the tank. He talks about a concept called taking a glucose break, which once when I presented this to a Hasidic Rebbe audience, they were laughing about that. A glucose break would be taking sugar through liquid form, so Powerade or Gatorade, sugary liquid drinks, go through the blood-brain barrier and can be utilized by the brain. Refilling that tank, the brain is working less efficiently, requires more energy, requires that glucose to be spread out. Historically, there's this idea that sugar is bad for ADHD, probably because people correlate in their own minds. Sugar seems to hype us up. ADHD children tend to have hyperactivity, therefore it's a bad mix. But the truth is, that might apply more to physical food sugar, but it does not really apply to liquid sugar. And I've had this experience with children who had severe ADHD and were bringing in school based on this discussion, were bringing around Powerade, sipping it throughout the day, and it really helped them in the classroom, even without medication. So that's something to think about, the different aspects of nutrition. Sleep. The sleep cycle is very important. There's research that shows that children who don't sleep properly, even without ADHD, will look like they have ADHD. So it's important to figure out what's happening with your students' sleep, make an alliance with the parent, and ask and work together with it. There's a sleep cycle that tends to downshift when children become teenagers. They might need more sleep in the morning and have a harder time falling asleep in the evening, and that might be an accommodation that some schools need to make sometimes for children. Have them come later. It might be worth the investment to get them the proper sleep. Of course, there's the whole nighttime routine. How do we adjust nutrition and exercise to set up our child better for sleep? If the first time your child is having protein is in the evening for supper, as a side effect of whatever, their body is actually starting to work in the evening, and then it's not proper to be able to set down for sleep. So how do we judge, how do we juggle giving them proper exercise, aerobic exercise when they come home from school, making sure they have their protein earlier on in the day, and cycling them down to proper sleep? Two minutes. Have a plan. The main idea for behavior tracks, which are very important, is that you need to externalize what should otherwise be internalized. The sense of motivation, breaking down tasks into small, doable, succeedable, accomplishable tasks, and helping the children make the connections between behaving and the rewards in the short term and the long term. The term of scaffolding, creating a scaffold around the child of behaviors, of charts, of expectations. There's a person I worked with who was in his 20s, who had adult ADHD, also had it as a child, and literally I made a chart for him of certain behavioral expectations, and I photocopied it 7 times, one for each shirt pocket that his mother had so neatly ironed or sent to the cleaners, which was holding it in his room, and his job was to put each copy when he got home from the session in each shirt pocket, so he had it set up for the week. And then he was going to self-monitor certain behaviors, make certain check marks for certain behaviors, but because it's physically in his shirt pocket, he was able to do that self-monitoring. And that's one of the ways of taking very well-defined behavioral plans, which if you're interested, email me. I will email you a proper behavior chart, which conforms to other ideas, and helping a child or an adult learn to generalize that to other behaviors. Number 12, it's important to join with a child to combat the executive functioning deficits. Give them the language that they don't have, that internalized speech that they don't have. Speak out to them what they need to understand and ask them to repeat it back until they develop the habits in their own thinking and the words that they have that they need for that internalized speech. Okay, I'll just end with one last piece. In Parsha Shlach, so the Torah talks about Tefelos. So the Klei Yachar quotes the Gemara Menachos, the famous Gemara. Why do we have Tefelos in our tzitzis? The Gemara says Tefelos doma liyam, liyam doma larakia, birakia doma lakis yakov. The Tefelos is similar to the ocean. The ocean similarly reminds us of the sky, and the sky reminds us of the kis yakov of Hashem. So the question is, why do you need all the intermediate steps? Why don't you just say Tefelos is similar and reminds us of the Kisei HaKavod? Who needs the ocean and the sky in the middle? They're all similar to each other. So the Klei Yachar explains that each of the sky and the ocean have different characteristics. The ocean is unbending, it's unyielding, it's a force of nature. When you sit in an ocean, you're just moved by it, you have no will, you have no power. That is Ovin Hashem Meira, that's fear. You just are pushed to it, fearful, and that's one way of Avodas Hashem. The sky, the Rakia, which we don't have time to get into now, is Oved Hashem Mi'ahava, from love. That's a relationship. And the order of this Gemara is Techeles Domel Yam, the Yam Domel Rakia, the Rakia Domel Hashemayim, the Kisei HaKavod. Only through the method of Oved Hashem Mi'ahava, of love, of the sky, only that way do you get to Dveikus, only that way do you become closer actually to Hashem. If you take it on our level in this talk, all of the techniques we talked about and the ones we didn't get to so much but are on your handout, they all work within a loving, caring relationship where the child wants to become closer. The Klei Yachar says, in the relationship of Yira, a person is motivated to move away from the source of that Yira. In the relationship of Ahava, a person is motivated to move closer to that source. Rabbi Tavis ended up by talking about children going off the derech. I definitely feel that ADHD is one of the silent killers both academically and in terms of staying on Aruch HaDerech, and keeping that relationship and using all these charts and motivational techniques and enduring all the frustrations within the relationship of Ahava is of primary importance. So I hope that you take a look at the slides. Feel free to email me or call with any questions, and I hope this was helpful. Thank you.